with you. So these are the things that are mentioned in Riwayat, for example, from Imam al-Sadiq. It is narrated that when a mu'min comes out from the grave and or resurrected on the Day of Judgment, he will see someone or something that moves in front of him.
Okay.
And then he asks...
Like a body.
That, yeah, like something bodily or physical. And then the mu'min asks that, who are you? Why are you with me? And then that thing would say that, of course, أَنَا السُّرُورُ الَّذِي كُنْتَ أَدْخَلْتَ عَلَىٰ أَخِيكَ الْمُؤْمِنِ فِي الدُّنْيَا خَلَقَنِيَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلْ مِنْهُ لِأُبَشِّرَكَ. Says that I am that kind of enjoyment or pleasure. Because of what? Because those pleasures that you gave to or you caused to your brother or to Muslim brother, mu'min, because of those favors that you did
favors,
for your,
yes,
for,
favors,
your
that's right.
For example, your brother, then that changed into this kind of thing that now you see, and I'm that one.
So I will be with you. This case is true about the evil actions too?
Of course.
It could be an imaginal body resurrected with you, but rooted in your evil actions.
Yeah, you might see like very dangerous, horrifying kind of creatures.
Oh.
The result of the wrong actions, bad actions, evil actions, they will embody themselves into the form of very dangerous, very horrifying, frightening kind of creatures. Yeah, of course, they are also mentioned in the holy, in our riwayat and ahadith.
That's all right. Very good. So, Brother Alavian, what lessons can we take from the embodiment of our actions? I mean, are these a kind of warning or notice from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give people a kind of lesson to be away from evil actions? Or no, they truly happen, as Sheikh said.
Yeah, actually, this is what some scholars actually are insisting on, that this embodiment of actions wants to warn us that whatever we do is with us, either good or bad.
Yes.
So to the extent that we get accustomed to doing good, so we can continuously be living with good actions of ours. Though some of these scholars actually showed their objection towards this concept of embodiment of action, like the late Allama Majlisi, he believed that this is in contradiction with bodily resurrection, Ma'ad al-Jismani. But again, there are lots of other, scholars who believe that this concept is true, and they have, accepted this concept very easily and even without any interpretation. They said that it has nothing to do with bodily resurrection, and it is not against these bodily resurrection. And since the actions are showing their effects, I mean, the fire that we're talking, the punishment that has been defined or has been actually warned or have been reported for us, that they are the fire for bad actions, the fire are here with us. So if we have got an open eye in this world, if we are blessed with this open eye in this world, then we can see our actions, and then we shall refrain from doing any action.
Yes.
So what is the consequence? What is the result? The result is that we have to work on ourselves.
Yes.
So as much as we try to refrain from any bad action.
Okay.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will institutionalize this being with good, with the effects of this good action in our existence, then we will be blessed with seeing and sensing, at least, not even necessarily with body eyes, with the eyes of spirit, right?
Yes, I know.
So we can see, I mean, the beauty of good actions, and we can even feel in case, God forbid, we do a bad action.
So, for example, when you are angry, it will show itself in the rays of heartbeat.
Yeah.
Or, for example, being red in your
These are the material consequences.
The natural consequences.
Yeah.
But in other places, it could be, for example, changed into quite fire.
Very true.
It is possible that your anger is changed energetically into a fire or
very
something
true.
Like that.
Okay. So
even scientifically, it is possible.
Scientifically possible.
Okay.
And even some of the people are men of mystics.
Yes.
They have always, wrote about these experiences of them in different forms and different situations that they have been in. And they actually explain the way that, for example, the outcome of or the result of a person who was continuously reciting salawat on the Holy Prophet and his household. So they have seen, I mean, that beautiful flower that was around that person. I mean, some of the scholars wrote and explained such things in their works in literature.
Just listen what Molavi says, the famous Persian poet, that گشته گرگان یک به یک خوهای تو. Your temperament has been changed into the wolves. می درانند از غضب اعضای تو. Out of anger, they will tear you apart. آن سخنهای چمار و کجدمت, all your utterances, who were like snakes and like dragons, ما رو کجدم گردد و گیرد دمد, will in fact and practically be changed into a snake and dragons and will tear you apart and will attack you. This is what Molana says in a very beautiful, says that sometimes we say that, for example, the language, that the tongue that you use against the others is like the poison of a snake, okay?
Yeah, sure.
So this poisonous snake will be shown to you truly in the other world.
Very true. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a very vivid witness for such a claim is that when you sit close to a mystic, let's say a ustad of ethics, or a believer, true believer, so you will find a sort of tranquility, and you can sense it. Or when you enter holy shrines of the Ahlul Bayt,
yes,
so this tranquility can be sensed on you. So this is due to the good action that you have done there, that you have entered that place due to the goodness of, or the greatness of the soul of that person.
Yes.
So, I mean, all are going to prove the embodiment of the actions.
Right.
Your action of entering this holy shrine and the result of or the result of good actions that person, that holy person did in his life or even his afterlife.
And is it possible, Shaykh Rouhani, to see the tamassul and the tajassum of your amal in this world? I mean, if you reach such high perfection, spiritually speaking, is it possible to see the very nature of your actions by your eyes?
Yeah, it is not something impossible, you know, rationally.
As the Aimmas, for example, did, Imam al-Hussein, for example, showed the true face and the destiny of the people and their actions to the companions.
It is mentioned that in Imam al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam, once some of his companions was very much happy and proud of seeing a lot of hujjaj in Hajj, in the time of the Hajj pilgrimage. So he told Imam al-Sadiq that, look, Ibn Rasulullah, there are numberless pilgrims gathered this year, and it is very, we can say, happy kind of event. Then Imam al-Sadiq told him that, please look at these pilgrims from between my two fingers.
Wow.
And then when he looked at the people, he saw different things, just few people among them.
The true face of the people,
And also we have a narration from one of the companions of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam that one day one of the companions of the Prophet came to the Prophet and told the Prophet that, O Prophet, would you please let me to tell you that among these companions around you, I know that which one is in the fire right now and which one is in the heaven.
Okay.
Can you let me please to tell about these companions? And the Prophet says that you are not allowed to reveal the secrets.
All right.
Hey, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala showed you something you are not allowed to see, to reveal those secrets.
Okay.
It is possible, but of course, it needs that.
Lots of training and perfection.
Level of perfection, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Shaykh Rouhani and Brother Al-Abiyan, for a nice elaboration regarding Tajassum al-A'mal. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
From Beirut.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of From Beirut. First of all, let me go ahead and welcome my guest today, Dr. Ahmad Nashebi, a political analyst. Welcome, Dr. Ahmad.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a few points to start off. First of all, after Israeli media yesterday evening started reporting that Hezbollah has been rather silent after only issuing around four statements, the resistance group actually started hitting Israel hard, specifically in central Israel, in Tel Aviv, around 2:30 a.m. We are going to move over also that the Pentagon is announcing that it's going to be deploying reinforcements to the Middle East. And Nabih Habir, the Lebanese speaker, parliament speaker, said that Israel is the one that rejected the Lebanon's ceasefire roadmap, while Gaza scenario is still possible. The new scandal engulfs Netanyahu after close aide arrested for alleged intel leak, according to Axios. And of course, yesterday, Israeli media or the Israeli entity continued its massacres in Gaza. So far, around 84 killed and 50 of those being children. Last but not least, candidate Trump, Donald Trump, met yesterday with Arab Americans, saying that he wants peace in the Middle East. Well, we are going to be starting off with the latest developments. Dr. Ahmad, yesterday, again, we went back to silence here in the southern suburbs of Beirut. But in return, the resistance played a new scenario on their side where they mentioned that after a long day of silence, it was planned that they actually hit Tel Aviv at around 2:30 a.m., the same time the night before Israel hit here on the southern suburbs, and the Israeli David Sling battery was actually activated to intercept these missiles fired from Lebanon to Tel Aviv. First of all, this scenario is not the first time that we've seen the resistance using it. Is this just basically just keeping up on Israel for what they're doing? We're going to return in kind.
Well, these are the rules of engagement that were announced by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah before he was killed.
Yes.
You know, and he said this all along, that, you know, there are rules of engagement. There are responses to any of the Israeli target in Lebanon. When they target Beirut, they target the southern suburb in such a violent way, then they should expect that Tel Aviv will be targeted. You know, these are, codes of conduct that have been agreed upon within the resistance. And, but we can see, if we observe overall, that the bombing of northern occupied Palestine, the settlements, the army bases, because the resistance has been focusing on targeting army bases and not civilian targets, has been increasing. And the area in the northern occupied part of Palestine has been that is targeted area is larger than it was at the beginning. And this kind of, it is a kind of stepping up the confrontation with the Israeli enemy, as the Israeli enemy fails to capture towns in southern Lebanon. We have reports that the Israelis sent thousands of troops, and they lost around 1,200 soldiers and officers since the beginning of the all-out war on Lebanon in the battlefield. So they are losing on the battlefield. They are not capable. They were surprised that Hezbollah did not collapse, because they thought that with all these attacks and the killing the leadership of Hezbollah, the attack with the pagers, the massive attacks on the southern suburb, that Hezbollah would lose its capacity and cannot actually confront them anymore. It turned out that the operational capacity and the military capacity of Hezbollah is intact. And Hezbollah is able to keep up with the battle even after a whole 13 months of confrontations with the Israeli enemy. This creates a lot of frustration on the part of the Israelis and their American and German and British allies, because they had presented a plan that was so perfect, let's put it this way. I mean, a perfect plan to destroy Hezbollah. And they implemented it perfectly.
This plan started with the pagers or before?
Pagers, I think, and with the assassination of the high-ranking officers within the resistance, the killing of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, which yes. was thought to be the end of the world for many people, and this party turned out to surprise everybody and has this capacity that even if you kill its leadership, even if you destroy its headquarters, even if you kill its so many of its civilians and its population, it will continue to fight and to resist, and in a very calm and efficient and organized manner. And that's really interesting. For example, in Beirut and in the rest of the country where so many people have been displaced, around 1 million people were displaced, there was no chaos in the sense that there was no armed people with guns or some serious incidents. Yes, there were some incidents here and there, tiny incidents. Overall, the situation is in control. There is a national unity overall. And the army is still, the Lebanese army is still in control, and the police. And there has been a kind of, I'm surprised, really, of, the capacity of the people and the society to keep the minimum unity and the how people are holding on to each other and helping each other. You see, most of the people who have been displaced from the south have moved to homes and to schools and to communities. Whereas on the other side, for the Israelis, the settlers, they move to hotels.
Oh, wow.
They're not communities. They are they're settlers.
In their country and abroad, right?
The Israelis are settlers who are taking a land and cities and villages that do not belong to them. They don't have the same characteristic as the rest of the people in the region. You see, they're settlers. Their origin is in Europe or in the United States. They just came here to steal a land and homes and a country that does not belong to them. Yes, they have support from the United States and Europe, and they have billions of dollars, and they have the most advanced technology. Yet they are fighting against the people who own the land. So those who own the land are going to fight till the end. They're never going to give up. And that is what the Israelis don't understand, apparently. And their Western allies don't understand that the people who own the land will never give up their land. It is their land.
Exactly. Well, standing united, as you're saying, is extremely important. And perhaps for people who do not know the background or the history of Lebanon, we have so many different parties, so many different backgrounds, so many different religions, and we all always live unified in this small country in comparison with the world.
Well, there
actually.
Were some clashes. There
yes.
were some tensions. There was
Obviously,
a civil
yes.
war. There were some issues, yes. And there continue to be issues and disagreements between various Lebanese. But I think overall, I don't think there will be a civil war. I think that the population don't want a civil war.
So despite that all
even,
the
even if they disagree with Hezbollah,
yes.
even if there is a population in Lebanon that disagrees with Hezbollah, it doesn't want to see a civil war. In fact, they disagree with Hezbollah because they blame Hezbollah for starting a war. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't actually replace this by starting another war. I mean, that doesn't make sense. So overall, I think that the people in Lebanon are... holding on to each other, they are helping each other. It's a challenge. The suffering is a lot of suffering, a lot of destruction, especially in the Bekaa, in the south, a lot of destruction. However, despite this destruction, the resistance is ongoing. On a daily basis, it bombs, it sends drones and rockets to the whole northern part of occupied Palestine
yes.
until Haifa. The Israeli military objective has been to return the settlers to northern occupied Palestine. This objective cannot be realized at this point. Sorry.
Well, Dr. Ahmad, also as you're mentioning, they have been taking big hits. The Israeli occupation army actually announced yesterday that the commander of the northern command, General Yuri Gordon, was actually injured yesterday
yeah,
in an incident.
He had a car accident.
Yes?
He had a car accident,
yes?
apparently.
Yes.
Well, it's from this frustration, they have to drive fast, maybe because they're afraid that there will be some drones or some missiles or a sniper from the resistance who will get him. So I think that they're a bit paranoid, and therefore they drive in a foolish way, and that's what happens when you are terrified of those who you're fighting against.
So it's that psychological war.
I think it's part of the psychological war. It doesn't make sense that he has like a car accident, he's a commander, unless there's really some kind of frustration and some kind of arrangement where they want to drive fast because
yes.
they don't want to be hit or something. And Hezbollah has proven to be able to hit the bedroom of Benjamin Netanyahu. So
yes.
therefore he's scared for his life, I think, and therefore maybe this kind of fear pushed him to behave in a way that was too dangerous and that led to this car accident.
Of course, a newly appointed Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Assem, also continued this psychological warfare by re-threatening Netanyahu also.
Yes, I think that, it's only normal. Netanyahu is a killer. He is a criminal. He's someone who's been, you know, on a murderous campaign since he started 1 year ago. I mean, this has been really something that shocked many people who still have some conscience around the world. But unfortunately, most governments around the world, especially Western governments, have been complicit and have been, in line with Netanyahu. This does not, I don't think this will go on forever, because they gave him this chance to finish the job, so to say, like to, you know, to actually be able to finish Hezbollah, finish Hamas, finish Islamic Jihad, and create a new Middle East where, you know, everything is contained and all the Arab countries and all the countries around Israel are ready to naturalize relations with Israel. And that's the plan for the new Middle East. Well, this plan is not, I think it's clear that it's not succeeding, to say the least. It's a total failure. It's a disaster, because they paid all this money and all this destruction and all these crimes and, you know, horrible, you know, all these children slaughtered for what? For nothing. They didn't even achieve their own objectives. They're not going to return to the northern part of occupied Palestine. The challenge is there. It was announced by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah before he was assassinated. And this challenge remains. You know, they will not return to the northern part of occupied Palestine, no matter what the cost. So, and Netanyahu doesn't know this, because Netanyahu thought that if he will, assassinate Nasrallah and bomb with the pages and destroy and do this and that, that Hezbollah will collapse and it will lose its capacity. But Netanyahu also had counted on another method that also failed drastically. That is civil war. Mm-hmm. He thought that, you know, first of all, Hezbollah will be destroyed because I did this to Hezbollah and I destroyed its leadership. And also, many Lebanese will rise against Hezbollah because they don't want to see their country being destroyed.
Yes.
That's what he thought. He thought that the Lebanese would say, well, they will blame Hezbollah. They would say, yeah, Hezbollah started the war with Israel, and therefore Hezbollah is responsible for the burning down and destruction of the country. Yes, there are some voices in Lebanon who say this, but are they ready to do any actions? Are they ready to move? I don't think so, because they know if any movement they will do against Hezbollah will lead to a civil war.
But we also have the U.S. Embassy playing its part.
Yes, it plays its part. It puts some pressure. It says, the American ambassador says, yeah, we must get ready for the period that is post-Hezbollah. Well, you know, I'm not sure. I think she's in a rush. And she's in a rush. Why would she be in a rush? She's in a rush because she knows that Hezbollah did not lose any of its capacity.
Exactly.
It still has a strong capacity internally and on the front, and its population. Yes, it's true, many people in Hezbollah lost their homes, lost their loved ones, lost their villages, their lands, their jobs, their entire families. But what is their choice? What choice do they have? Do they surrender and give up their weapons and then be slaughtered like Al-Mukhtar al-Thuqafi? Or they hold on to their guns and they continue with their battle, and they're being victorious and successful by being there in the south, by defending the villages, by preventing the Israelis from entering these villages. They are achieving victories every single day.
Exactly. Isn't it that history basically is repeating itself? We learn from history, and that's what I believe the Israeli entity is forgetting.
Yes, I think they did this before. I mean, they did this in 1982. I mean, Hezbollah are not Iranians. They are Lebanese, supported by Iran. They thought they could deal with them the same way they dealt with the Palestinians. When the PLO was here in 82, yes, at the end, you know, they reached a deal where they asked the PLO to leave Beirut, and they left to Tunisia, to Egypt, to Iraq, to several countries. Hezbollah are not going anywhere. They are Lebanese, like any other Lebanese, and they hold on to their villages, their lands, and they will hold on to their guns no matter what the pressure and no matter what the cost. And so many people, so many diplomats don't understand this. And I think, you know, their failure to understand this will lead to more blood, more bloodshed, more destruction. You have to understand that you cannot ask the people of southern Lebanon and the Bekaa to give up their weapons when you killed their children, you slaughtered them, you bombed their homes, and you took their land.
Well,
it's not possible.
Exactly. I believe this is a problem that many do not understand. When it comes to the lands here in the area, they have been in here for generations. The grandchildren continue to stay on the land of their great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers. And this is something that's definitely not in the Israeli entity. And even when it comes to the U.S., how long has the U.S. Been actually a country? And actually, it's a mixing pot. It wasn't originally their land at the beginning.
Yes, well, no, you know, on that subject, you know, I don't want to go too far, but I would say, you know, they had to exterminate the natives. I mean, you know, they had to do a genocide. I mean, that's why the United States is so understanding of the Israeli genocide, because it says, yeah, you know what, the argument could be, well, what do you want, the Cherokee tribes or the Iroquois or the other tribes that were the actual owners of the land, then there wouldn't be any United States of America. Mm-hmm. These white people came all the way from Europe to take away the land from the natives, and they slaughtered them. And by the hundreds of thousands.
Yes.
So therefore, this is a nation, unfortunately, I mean, for any American who would actually want to look at the things in a truthful manner, yes, well, the United States is based on genocide. You know, that's the truth. I mean,
exactly.
you built a nation where you are based on the extermination of a whole population.
Yes.
You know, and therefore, I think Imam Khomeini, when he said that America Shaitan al-Akbar, that the United States is the great Satan, that is exactly what he meant. A Satan is a symbol for someone who actually violates the rights of others and takes their belongings in a ruthless, aggressive way and slaughters your children, your family in return, you know, and will take everything you own and doesn't care.
Exactly.
You know, and that is exactly what the Israelis have been doing. They have found no solutions for the Palestinians. When there was a solution, or it wasn't really a good solution in Oslo, they killed their own prime minister.
Yes.
And that wasn't even a solution, but talking about a solution is unacceptable for these people. They are racist. They consider themselves God's chosen people, superior to any other people. So they want to take the whole land, and they want to take part of Lebanon, they want to take Syria, they want to take Iraq. This is not an illusion. They have a map, and it's on their military uniforms.
Yes.
So they have this ambition to expand and to enlarge their country, or the country they occupied.
Well, Doctor, you did mention at the beginning of the show, we're talking about the ground and specifically the southern villages and, of course, Bika, Hermel, Baalbek, all these villages other than the southern suburbs of Beirut. We've seen definitely an escalated aggression by the Israelis. Why is this specifically?
Well, I think that the escalation is a sign that they do not have targets anymore, because the escalation is targeting civilians.
Yes.
And civilian centers, and you know, they're targeting civil defense and ambulances and mm-hmm. firefighters. In Sur, they targeted firefighters and ambulances in a direct way. I mean, they're targeting United Nations employees, the peacekeeping forces, same way they targeted UNRWA in Gaza, they're targeting UNIFIL in southern Lebanon. They're targeting journalists, so far 162 journalists, and here they go again.
I believe it's
with
a sound barrier.
Sonic boom.
And we'll see, it's most likely a sonic boom sound barrier. If we hear the second one, we'll let you know, or you'll hear it.
Yeah,
yes,
well,
Doctor.
It's a continuous threat. I mean, the Israelis, and you know, and journalists are worried, you know.
There's the second one.
Journalists are worried because journalists have been killed. So many journalists have been
yes.
killed, you know. You have 162 journalists who have been killed since a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And they target journalists deliberately. I mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, instill fear among our colleagues here, but I mean, you know,
everyone
the Israelis,
knows the cost.
Yeah,
exactly,
I mean, the
yeah.
Israelis have no, they wouldn't actually, you know, hesitate in slaughtering journalists. I mean,
yes.
You know, they killed also Lebanese army officers. Now, when the Israeli enemy does this, you know, it means that they lost, they don't have enough military targets anymore. So they want to show victory by slaughtering people. It is a killer regime, a killer ideology, you know, and that's really unfortunate.
Well, some people are saying that they're asking this question, actually. They're actually asking if the U.S. election really is a choice of between genocide and fascism.
Fascism, yeah. I think that it's horrible. I think, you know, the American administration did not find a way to deal with this situation in a way that would, respect the basic human dignity of everybody. It tried to play in the days of Jimmy Carter, tried to play a role, a balanced role between, you know, it wants to make peace between Israelis and Arabs and wants to create a balance. It failed, obviously, but it tried. Now it's not even trying anymore. It's like so pro-Israel, so, engaged with Israel to the bones. I mean, I don't think that anything that Israel did in Palestine or in Lebanon was without cooperation, full cooperation, or even supervision by the Americans.
Well, for some viewers, could you just elaborate a bit on what part actually AIPAC has in the U.S. government?
Well, AIPAC is a think tank, and it is an association where many, pro-Israeli Zionists, they don't have to be Jewish. They could be Republicans. A Zionist doesn't have to be Jewish. In fact, there are many Jewish who are anti-Zionists.
Yes.
And, AIPAC is a lobby, a Jewish lobby. And when you use the term Jewish lobby, they accuse you of anti-Semitism, but it's a reality.
It's there. Terminology.
And the AIPAC pays with other Jewish agencies, Zionist agencies, they pay for the campaigns for members of Congress and members of the Senate when they run for elections. And so they pay for their campaigns, they contribute.
Yes.
And therefore, when they become members of parliament, members of Senate, they have to pay back by expressing their absolute support for Israel in all matters that have to do with providing aid, providing military support, providing direct military action to defend Israel. And this is a commitment by the United States that has become harder than stone. I mean, since the 60s. And that's the Americans chose Israel as their bully in the region, and especially in this region that is so rich in natural resources. So they need a bully, and they need to arm that bully so he can scare everyone in the region, and everybody would be terrorized from that bully. And that's how the Americans can ensure American interests.
Well, we have had a lot of the headlines on Donald Trump, but actually I do want to go over a bit to Kamala Harris. We have seen her stance, we have seen the people supporting her, and even a lot of people on media outlets have said that the situation in the area with Amos Hawkson, etc., is for her benefit. Where does she stand at the moment, in your opinion, according to the polls?
I think that I don't think she has the popularity. Maybe most of her popularity is because some of the voters are annoyed of Trump. They don't necessarily want her.
Because she tried him before, perhaps?
I don't think that they would want him to take over. Many Democrats or many people in the center, they don't really appreciate the fact that Trump is going to be president again. I mean, obviously, they want to do anything to fight him, and that's why they would vote for Kamala Harris. But Kamala Harris herself, I don't see where her achievements are. Where is her mark?
Yes.
I don't see her mark. The Biden administration has failed so drastically that she couldn't save it in any way.
Yes.
Or couldn't explain this total failure or this total support for genocide. She spoke several times of some humanitarian matters that had to do with, the fact that people are being slaughtered in Gaza and all. But that's nonsense, because her administration has been supporting this genocide all along.
Very true. Well, we have around a minute left, Doctor. If indeed Donald Trump does come to office, do you believe that he has learned anything from his previous term?
No, I don't think these people learn from previous terms. I think they are this kind of character. He would go on with what he has been doing because he thinks he hasn't been doing it in a proper way. So he wants to do it, he wants to go stronger. He wants to, this time, he's going to be harder on money. That's what I think he's going to be. And that is something that's related to what's going on over here, because
yes,
I don't think that Trump will pay any money for the Israelis.
At all.
At all. Trump wants to make America great again, and making America great again means not paying neither to Ukraine nor to Israel nor to anyone.
So it no means more financial assistance to Israel?
No more financial assistance from the Americans to Israel. But then Trump will go to the Gulf and he will tell the Gulf countries that you have to pay for Israel. And if you don't pay to Israel, you know, you will lose your security. And there are American bases all over these Gulf countries. So they will have to pay the Israelis. The Americans are not going to pay. And if they reject that, we're going to start to see some problems in the Gulf.
Well, definitely something to see. Well, I'm afraid our time has run out. I'd love to thank my guest, as always, Dr. Armon Ashebi, political analyst. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Until next time, goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Donald Trump's Madison Square Garden rally has been overshadowed by his allies' crude and racist remarks. The event in Deep Blue, New York City, was designed to mark the start of Trump's closing argument in the final days of the campaign. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump delivered his standard lines on topics from immigration to the economy on Sunday, 27th of October, at a packed rally at Madison Square Garden, an event that was designed to be the start of his closing argument 9 days out from Election Day on 5th of November. But Donald Trump's remarks in his hometown of New York City, which went for more than an hour, were overshadowed by comments made by warm-up speakers in the roughly 5 hours before his prime-time address. They included a comedian's racist jokes about Latinos and black Americans and were condemned by multiple Republican members of Congress, as well as speakers who used increasingly inflammatory language to describe Vice President Kamala Harris. At the world's most famous arena and before one of his largest rally crowds of the cycle, Donald Trump railed against opponents he sees as the enemy within, describing the media as the enemy of the people, and referred to Kamala Harris's low IQ and described her as a vessel for those aforementioned opponents. Trump said, "It's just this amorphous group of people, but they're smart and they're vicious, and we have to defeat them." Trump was explaining his use of the term the enemy from within. He continued by saying, "And when I say the enemy from within, the other side goes crazy. They've done very bad things to this country. They're indeed the enemy from within, but this is who we're fighting." David Rem, who announced his candidacy for mayor of New York on stage, echoed a rallygoer who called Harris the devil and added that she is the Antichrist. Conservative media personality Tucker Carlson joked that Kamala Harris, who's black and of Indian descent, would be the first Samoan-Malaysian low-IQ former California prosecutor ever to be elected U.S. president. But no comments generated more attention than an opening routine from comedian Tony Hinchcliffe, who spoke early in the afternoon. His jokes targeted Puerto Rico, describing it as a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Then he told a joke about how he and a black friend carved watermelons together. There was an uncomfortable reception to his punchlines in the arena. Within hours of his remarks, multiple pro-Trump GOP members of Congress condemned him. Representative Maria Elvira Salazar, Republican of Florida, said she was disgusted by his racist comment calling Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage, adding the rhetoric does not reflect Republican values. Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, said the joke bombed for a reason, was not funny and not true. And Representative Carlos Jimenez, Republican of Florida, said Hinchcliffe's comments were completely classless and in poor taste. I'm proud to be a Puerto Rican, Representative Anthony Desposito, Republican of New York, who's locked in a competitive House race, posted on X. My mother was born and raised in Puerto Rico. It's a beautiful island with a rich culture and an integral part of the United States. The only thing that's garbage was a bad comedy set. Stay on message. The Trump campaign sought to distance itself from comedian Tony Hinchcliffe's routine. In a statement, senior advisor Daniel Alvarez said, "This joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign." The Trump campaign had hyped up the event as what amounted to Trump's final pitch to voters in the closing days of the election. And he did offer some new policy positions from the stage, among them what he would support a tax credit for family caregivers who take care of a parent or loved one, which comes as Kamala Harris has heavily promoted her proposal to expand Medicare to allow it to cover long-term in-home care. Homing in on his core immigration pitch, Donald Trump also said he wants any migrant who kills someone in the United States to face the death penalty. And he offered insight into his thinking about how Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the former independent presidential candidate who is backing Trump's bid, would fit into a future Trump administration. Kennedy would go wild on health, Trump said. I'm going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on medicines. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this same story. Thousands of people from around New York area and other parts of the country descended on Madison Square Garden in New York City on Sunday afternoon, 27th of October, for former President Donald Trump's campaign rally. The New York Police Department said it had drones over the area, robots and a helicopter, as well as anti-terrorism units outside monitoring the situation to keep everyone safe. With just 9 days to go until Election Day on 5th of November, a new CBS News opinion poll has two presidential candidates neck and neck, with Vice President Kamala Harris at 50% and Donald Trump at 49% among likely voters. In battleground states, both are polling at 50%. The focus of their respective campaigns has been on issues including immigration, Israel's war in the Gaza Strip, and crime. Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, Elon Musk, and Melania Trump all spoke at the rally. Sunday's rally marked a detour from the battleground states for Trump. When Trump entered the arena, there was applause, a standing ovation, and the crowd started chanting. Every seat appeared to be filled from the floor to the highest sections. In his remark, Trump framed Vice President Kamala Harris as a train wreck and said electing her would gamble with the lives of millions of Americans. His speech included familiar campaign lines about immigration, his deportation plans, crime, the border with Mexico, and the economy. Trump said, "We will rapidly defeat inflation and we will very simply make America affordable again." And you know who I want to thank? New York City Mayor Eric Adams, because Mayor Adams has been treated pretty badly. You know, when he said this whole thing with the migrants coming into New York, this is just not sustainable. I said, well, he's going to be indicted by these lunatics. A year later, he got indicted, Trump said. He also played a video montage that included stories about migrants in gangs allegedly committing violent crimes across the country. Trump added, it's called Trendagua, and now they've even taken over Times Square. On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history to get the criminals out. And those who took the stage before the former president spoke were vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance and billionaire Trump supporter Elon Musk. In a surprise, Melania Trump, Donald Trump's wife, also made an appearance and introduced her husband. It was her first public political speech on the campaign trail. Other speakers included Robert Kennedy Jr., former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and television personality Dr. Phil McGraw.
A window to Palestine.
Soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Por siempre Palestina.
Hola a todos y a todas. Muy
hello everyone, very welcome again. In the ongoing genocide in Gaza, those most affected have undoubtedly been Palestinian women. Since the genocide began, we have seen images of thousands of women running from one place to another, looking for safe routes with their children in order to save them from this genocide. They have been put in the media around the world only as victims without seeing the depth of what the resistance of Palestinian women means. Some have had to give birth in improvised places without having any type of assistance or medications that can alleviate the pain of childbirth. Others have done their job as journalists, like Huda Hijazi, who invites us to know the truth of what is happening. In this program, we will focus on history, current events, and the role that Palestinian women have always played in the Palestinian cause. Let's dig deeper, analyze and understand more.
Palestina se está produciendo un genocidio.
A genocide is taking place in Palestine. There are more than 5,500 women who are currently pregnant in Gaza Strip, who are full term, and who are going to give birth. Therefore, it is urgent that we exercise our international leadership to immediately promote economic sanctions and the arms embargo against those responsible for this genocide. Starting with Netanyahu and his minister of war, bring those responsible for this genocide to the international court.
According to official figures, more than 70% of all victims who have been murdered in this ongoing genocide are women and children, and the world watches with absolute complicity. I invite you to delve deeper with the following video from our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi, to understand more the plight of Palestinian women today.
Según el Ministerio de Sanidad palestino,
according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We are talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages, and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there is a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see, and if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have 1 bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10. The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
We thank Hoda for this great report. This is what is happening there. This is what is happening today. However, the entire story of Palestinian resistance is intimately linked to Palestinian women. I invite you to take a short break, but don't go anywhere because in the next section we're going to talk with a very, very special guest. Well, we're back and we have a very special guest. This is Saida Godaya, activist and co-founder of the Karama Complex, which means dignity. Hello, Saida. Thank you very much for accepting this invitation. I want to start by asking you an absolutely important question. The international media, these media outlets that have long been seduced by the Zionist narrative, always deliver an absolutely stereotypical image of Palestinian women. Can you tell us what the historical role of Palestinian women has been in the Palestinian cause, but also in the current resistance?
Hola, muchas gracias por darnos...
Hello, thank you very much for giving us a voice. Indeed, as you mentioned, the Western media, above all, give a completely biased and stereotyped image of what Palestinian women are. Palestinian women have been in the fight since the beginning of the uprising against the occupation. There's a very special interest in the Western media in making us see Palestinian women as submissive women, completely dependent on men, on the family, which is not true at all. Since the time of the British Mandate and since the end of the Ottoman Empire, women have been organizing in all areas of life to fight against the occupation, both culturally, economically, and politically. There's data and bibliographies that document this claim. At that time, there were specific organizations, student organizations, women's unions, women's associations. In 1903, in the Palestinian city of Acre, the first Orthodox Society of Palestinian Women was formed, who complained and had their own demonstrations and organized against the occupation and the unfair permission that the British Mandate was giving for the mass immigration of the Zionists to our land. It is worth highlighting a Congress of Palestinian Women in 1929, where they also established ties with other feminist organizations and had their own demands against the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Both urban women and rural women participated and were active. I want to highlight the strength, the capacity, the decision-making capacity, the determination, and the high culture that Palestinian women have and the determination they have in the struggle. We have our own voice, our own vote. We study, we fight, and we focus our studies whenever we can to contribute to this cause. In the years of the mandate of the first wars, women were trusted with responsibilities apart from the traditional role that is often given to them as caregivers. I mean, beside that, they actually also did it as aid to the wounded, but they were also highly involved in what was the preparation of leaflets, in the demonstrations, in the boycotts, in the supply and transportation of weapons, and also in the armed struggle. That was years ago, many years before the occupation, because we have been under occupation for a century. Now, there's a lot of talk about Palestine since October 7th, but the aggression towards our people has not started on October 7th, and we have been suffering from the aggression towards our people for a century. I want to tell you that today Palestinian women continue to fight. Proof of this is the number of Palestinian women we have inside Zionist prisons in the stratum of society in which they are. I mean, they are deprived from some of their social rights. We have women within the Legislative Council who are imprisoned, constantly entering and leaving Israeli prisons, like Khalida Jarrar. There is Ahed Tamimi, a young teenager, who from a very young age began her activism against the Israeli occupation. She confronted a soldier when she was only 17 years old, since she was 17 years old. And then last year, there is the killing of a well-known journalist, Shirin Abu Akleh. She was executed before the eyes of the whole world. A journalist in her regular journalist uniform was executed for the whole world to see.
Muchas gracias, Saida. Vamos a pasar.
Thank you very much, Saida Godaya. Let's hear from the attendees.
Hola, buenas. Soy Tomás. Soy estudiante de filosofía y me gustaría.
Hello, I'm Thomas. I'm a philosopher student, and I would like to ask the following question: how do occupation policies limit women's employment opportunities, freedom of movement, and access to essential services?